Hey everybody, this is Alex Merced from alexmerced.com, and what I'm going to do today in today's podcast is talk about rights versus privileges. Because oftentimes what you see in political discourse is that people will label things rights. And generally the implication is when someone calls something a right, is that the right is something that everyone should have, and it is the duty of the government to guarantee that right, in a sense. That's sort of the... So basically, if someone wants government to spend money giving everyone a thing, they just call it a right. It just basically, what it does, it just shuts down the argument, because if you call something a right, then saying that you're against the provision of it is like you're saying you're against people's rights. Okay, which, again, is just sort of the rhetorical play. And this gets down to sort of a very fundamental debate in politics, which is the debate between negative and positive rights. Which, again, I'm going to take a little slightly different take on that in a little bit, but first let's just kind of give you sort of what the typical political debate is. So the idea behind negative and positive rights, which I think was an idea originated by the philosopher Isaiah Berlin, the idea behind this was that you have certain rights that are inherent, in the sense that they are things you have by default, like the ability to talk, free speech, okay? No one has to enable me to talk. I can just speak. So the only way for me to not be able to speak is for someone to take away my ability to speak. So negative rights, you start with them, and for you to no longer have them, someone has to take them away. A positive right is something you don't necessarily inherently have. I don't inherently have a doctor. I don't inherently have a teacher who's going to teach me. Okay? So in order for me to have these things, I have to provide them for myself, or someone has to provide them for me. These are positive rights. So the idea is that the only way to guarantee that you have access to these things is for others to actively work towards that obligation, whether by choice or by force. Okay? So in that case, when you say, hey, healthcare is a right, you're saying, hey, government should do whatever it takes to make sure you have access to healthcare. In that case, and to any extent that it fails to do so, it is violating your rights, which is kind of extreme when you really think about it, because at the end of the day, there isn't an infinite amount of doctors. So if all the money in the world doesn't necessarily mean there's an available doctor with an available appointment for you at this point. So in that case, you don't have access to care. So does that mean the government is failing to have your rights, and somehow they're supposed to just magically make doctors appear out of thin air? There's a scarcity of goods and resources. So there's a dangerous idea, the dangerous line when you start calling things randomly rights or scarce things rights. It doesn't mean people shouldn't have them. Okay? I prefer the rhetorical terminology of privilege for a variety of reasons. Now, when you think about healthcare and education, I do think these are privileges that more people, if not all people, should have. But again, the difference between calling something a privilege versus calling something a right is that a right kind of implies that you have no responsibility of maintaining it, in a sense. Okay, so you take a look at people's relationship to their rights. They very often take them for granted, which is fine for things like free speech, because they're there by default. Like, you have the ability to speak by default. You don't have to do anything extra. So the fact that you take it for granted doesn't necessarily affect your ability to speak, okay, or live. Okay, you may take your life for granted, but it is, doesn't affect the ability for your continued life or your continued ability to speak, because it's just something you have. Although, again, even those should probably be thought of as privileges, because when something is thought of as a privilege, then it denotes a certain level of responsibility for maintaining it. Okay, so for example, I grew up fairly poor. Okay, I grew up in, not the roughest ways, but now I have a sort of more middle-classy life that's a privilege. Okay, and I realize that's a privilege. In that case, I realize there's a responsibility on my part to make sure that it stays that way. Okay, that I need to, sharpen my skills, always be looking for new opportunities, always be trying to think about how do I keep the quality of life that I enjoy now. because it's a privilege. Now, well, of course, there's always more that I would like, but even what I have now is a privilege that I am responsible. I have a level of responsibility for maintaining. Okay? And so even negative rights, I like to think of as privileges. My right to free speech is a privilege. Okay? And at the end of the day, like, you know, if people, if everyone out there, like, that's the thing, at the end of the day, even your negative rights aren't inherently guaranteed. Because inherently, if enough people suddenly think it's okay to take away your right to free speech, they can. And, or if enough people get together and agree that, hey, you should die, they can take your life. Okay, and if enough of them agree, at the end of the day, like, you know, we can talk about sort of like liberty, natural rights, but at the end of the day, like, when you're existing in society, like, all ethics, all social rules are all under the presumption that we are living with others, that we are coexisting. Okay, or else why would you need them? Okay, if I was alone in an island, ethics don't matter. Okay, institutions don't matter. It's just me. Okay, it doesn't matter what's a right, what's a privilege, it's just me. Okay, so all of this philosophizing doesn't matter. It's all for the purpose of coexistence. It's all for the purpose of saying, okay, we do have a society where several individuals are coexisting. How do we make that work? Okay. So at the end of the day, like, there is a responsibility I have in making sure that I maintain my ability to speak, to maintain my ability to live. So to me, at the end of the day, that's even that's a privilege. There are no rights, period. There are only privileges. Okay. But I think the responsibility of me maintaining my privileges is generally, well, to the extent that I can impose an obligation to maintain my privileges, I can only impose that on myself. So that's sort of the difference in sort of like how probably a lot of other people think. But more so than the sort of like who has the obligation thing, I would just want to focus more on the rhetorical difference between privilege and right. Because you take a look at like K through 12 education, you say, okay, kids, you have a right to education, so you have to go to K through 12 school. Okay, this is an obligation you have. Okay, because it's your right. So they have to make you do it. Kind of weird when you really think about it. But notice, like, a lot of kids don't take their K through 12 education quite for granted. And less so when you start getting to like things like college, where, you know, you have a little bit more expense. It's not necessarily something you have to do. You know, your relationship between what is and what isn't is a little bit different. Okay, when there's a chance you may not have something, you treat it quite differently. Or at least when it's at least rhetorically possible. Again, that's why I like the word privilege. Okay, because it is possible that if I don't sit there and I don't advocate for my ability to speak, I don't advocate for my ability to live, that one day the culture could shift to a place where people want to take my life, where people want to squelch my ability to speak. So I have to take action to personally, I'm responsible for maintaining my privileges. Cool. Okay. But at the same time, I wish that all other individuals have as many privileges as possible. I don't only want to create an environment where most people are going to have the ability to speak and to live, but I do want the ability where more people than possible can be healthy, have access to care when they need it, have access to education if they so choose, that they have access to these things. Okay, but again, these resources are scarce. These privileges are finite. Okay, there's only so many teachers out there. There's only so many doctors out there. There's only so much actual materials to make the medicines and the tools for education, etc. Okay, now with education, with like, you know, e-schooling and whatnot, you definitely have a little bit more expansion of capacity, but again, it's still not infinite. Not everybody learns the same, you know, from watching a video like I would versus, you know, having someone live in front of you teaching, giving you one-on-one attention. Okay, so there isn't necessarily the same ability to give the same level of education to everyone, but you want access. So in that case, the idea is you want to think about what are the things that make it where supply expands. Okay, it's not just a matter of saying, you know what, this is a right everyone should have it, so government just pay whatever it takes to make sure everyone has it. Okay, because again, if you just sit there and say, hey, everyone has access to school, again, there's just not an infinite supply of teachers. There just isn't an infinite supply of doctors. So if you really want everyone to have access, you got to think about the supply side, the how how do you create a situation where there may be more teachers, there may be more doctors, the prices may go down. Okay, and you take a look at any other goods, service, etc. It comes down to market dynamics. It comes down to the division of labor. It comes down to pricing incentives, in the sense that, hey, you know what? If doctors are, if suddenly there's not enough doctors, yeah, doctors are going to be cost more money. They're going to, you're going to pay more to go to the doctor's appointment, but that's going to incentivize more people to become doctors. Okay, because again, what we like to believe that every doctor became a doctor for altruistic reasons. At the end of the day, there isn't enough people who do things for altruistic reasons to satisfy the wants and needs of everybody. So you do need people who are incentivized by other means, such as economic means. So you would want there to be more teachers. The profit of educating has to be there. Okay, and then that's the problem is, like, in a public space, in a public, you take a look at, like, the way public schools function, it just doesn't work in a way that teachers could really be paid all that much more. Okay, and there's a lot of other people who end up being, and then also just public goods end up having so much many layers of bureaucracy and administration that there's a lot of people who end up getting paid money that would probably be better going being paid the teachers, which would create an incentive for more people to become teachers, meaning more teachers available to all. But it's just no way, because again, when you have a public system, a government system, there just has to be all these layers of bureaucracy, because again, you don't have the same resource constraints. You don't have the same incentives, because in a private business, again, everybody could lose their job if the company shuts down. You could lose your wealth if the company fails. So everyone has kind of an incentive to try to work in a sort of same direction without as many layers of checks and bureaucracy and whatnot. And you actually have an incentive to maintain that governance with as little bureaucracy as possible. While in government, it's like you'll kind of generally exist either way. I mean, you know, whether the end result is good or bad, but the idea is no one wants to be the person who gets, like, blamed for the problems. So the idea is you create a lot of checks and approvals, and there's so many people who have to be involved in any kind of decision. There's no one person who can really take, who's really given liability. And then since there's no one whose resources are necessarily really on the line directly is involved, there's all the incentives are more about trying to, like, cover your ass than it is about necessarily the end thing. It doesn't mean, and again, I do believe wholeheartedly, like, that people become teachers because they want to be teachers, that people become doctors because they want to be doctors, and that they care about their patients, that they care about their students. But at the end of the day, like, bureaucracy can kill a dream easily, okay? You meet people who are in any kind of field, they go into it for the right reasons, they have the altruism, but they get so stuck in the bureaucracy of things that the bureaucracy ends up putting out that sort of fierce light in them over time. And then over time, they just become part of the bureaucracy. They become an advocate for the bureaucracy. Okay? Because they start, you know, they forget why they were there in the first place over time. Again, it's not that people go into education or go into being a doctor for the wrong reasons. They don't. And even if they do it for economic reasons, generally people want to do a good job. But hey, you spent several years where your ability to grow is limited because, you know, you're not reward based necessarily on, like, merit doesn't have a way. Again, merit is not the only thing. Okay, that's the thing. I'm not for necessarily a pure meritocracy. That's, I think people overweigh that as far as how do you run a society. Merit, meaning how hard you work, matters. But there's a lot of other things that matter, like, you know, having a well-balanced team that with people with diverse enough skills and knowledge sets to do what you want. So, you know, if I were to hire, a team, if I were to put a football team with all the best quarterbacks, but I didn't think about, you know, any of the other roles, okay, yeah, a team of all the best quarterbacks wouldn't necessarily still be the best team possible. So it's about sort of the composition, okay? There are so there's other aspects other than just pure merit, but at the same time, a lot of times what happens is in public systems, because of bureaucracy, it becomes more of purely like a seniority thing. So in that case, it's a matter your ability to grow is oftentimes a function more of your ability to sit and wait and not shake the boat than to shake the boat and do amazing things. So again, you have all these sort of just natural incentives sort of in public systems that make them not the best place to have the right division of labor to give people those privileges. So again, when I criticize the public provision of education, the public provision of healthcare, and the public, it's not that I don't want people to have healthcare and education. I do. Okay? But the idea is that generally those sectors oftentimes don't make the most efficient use of resources. And that matters because the more efficiently used resources, the more you're able to distribute it among more people. Okay? If I use $100, if I have $1,000 to educate people, and I'm spending $100 per person, well, then I can only educate 10 people. But if I can do it within $10 per person, now I can educate 100 people. Let me think about that. 10, yeah. 100 people. And that's good, okay? You want efficient use of resources. And again, people try to associate more resources with better outcomes. Not necessarily. Oftentimes, it's actually quite the opposite. Because resource constraints oftentimes have you think harder about how to do a good job. But also at the same time, people want to spend less. But when you have competition, you have to provide more for less to win the competition. You don't have these dynamics necessarily in public education. And you definitely, and to a less extent, you'd have them in healthcare. Okay, so while there's competing doctors, there's a lot of things that just make it really hard to, like, really have a lot of autonomy in the healthcare system right now. It's just really opaque, really disconnected from the individual really having the kind of information and flexibility and purchasing power that would allow them to really have a consumer-based healthcare. Because at the end of the day, like, really who's paying all the providers is most oftentimes the insurance company, so they care about the insurance company, and the insurance company who's paying the insurance company is oftentimes the employer, so they care about the employer, kind of leaving the end patient sort of out of the whole sort of incentive mix for the most part. So again, the point being is that I want people to have privileges, as many privileges as possible. I want people to be privileged. I don't think people should feel bad about being privileged. Now, their privileges should not come out of the expense of others to the extent that it's possible. Okay, so to the extent that, you know, you can live a better life, you should do so. At the point that I encourage you to create an environment that protects your privileges, again, protects your right, your ability to speak, your ability to live, your ability to succeed, okay, I encourage you to do so. You should take that responsibility over the context in which your privileges exist, because creating a context which privileges can be maintained is creating a context in which other people's privileges can be attained. Okay? If you're not allowed to maintain something, you're not allowed to maintain something. If you're not allowed to maintain something, you're not allowed to attain something. So it's about giving people that opportunity. And again, creating that environment where people individually try to figure out ways to provide education, to provide healthcare, to create that division of labor, to discover better pricing, to discover better mechanisms for doing all these things, better pricing, better quality, whatnot, finding new ways without all this bureaucracy that makes these industries very inflexible, makes it very hard, and almost punishes you for trying to innovate. Okay, when you think about the level of bureaucracy, the amount of different kinds of approvals and paperwork, the minute you want to try to do something different against what has always been done, okay, it can be very punishing, and then at the same time very costly, okay, to the point where it can almost ruin you, okay, when you try to be sort of entrepreneurial in healthcare or education, okay, I mean more specifically K-12 education, when you're doing sort of more optional education, and you see really great options when you take a look at sort of like continuing education, post-secondary education that's, you know, outside of sort of like the university system. And the reason why the university system kind of has the same level of bureaucracy is because they depend a lot on money from the government. So while they're not necessarily run by government most of the time, they are stuck within a sort of system of accreditation, which is sort of run by government, which means they have a lot of strings that they have to kind of, that are kind of attached to them. So that way they can be qualified to get paid through like Pell Grants and, you know, government funds. Having that, and that's how a lot of things get regulated. A lot of things you don't have to follow the rules that government gives you, but government system says, hey, we'll pay for people to do the thing, and that dependence on government outlays creates that mechanism for which they control. Okay, it's like parents. Okay, when you live in their house, they set the rules. But oftentimes, once you leave home, maybe they pay for your apartment. Okay, so yeah, you may have left home, but now that they pay for your apartment, they set rules for how your apartment can be. Okay, at the end of the day, like, for industries to have true independence, to be able to really have create the systems of privileges that we want in society, they do need to be sort of independent from sort of this paternal central planning. Okay, and I don't mean just making this paternal central planning optional. It just needs to not, on that side, because at the same time, the way that paternal central planning is funded is through sort of compulsion as well. But the idea is just sort of trying to maximize the context of consent, the context of people, and also the culture of responsibility, the culture that we realize that, hey, we have all these privileges in life and we are responsible for maintaining them, and taking that responsibility seriously. And the more we use the word right, the more I feel like that is diminished. So yes, I want as many people as possible to have the privileges, as many privileges as possible. But at the end of the day, everything is a privilege. And we all have a responsibility in maintaining those privileges. And I think that while it's just rhetorical, while it's just semantics, it does matter. Okay, because the words we choose, the metaphors we choose, they affect the way we think about the world around us. They affect how we see things. And that matters. And I think that matters a lot more than a lot of people will admit. Okay, word matters. And this is why, you know, we end up having all these like debates about like, identity and inclusiveness, because language matters. Not only in this whole privilege thing, but also just having a culture where the linguistics kind of make you feel like you are part of society, which is why I generally am for sort of innovations in language for like inclusivity, because I want everyone to feel like they are part of the team, that everyone cares about the privileges we all have. Because if everyone cares about the privileges that we all have, then everyone will care enough to maintain those privileges. They will care enough to allow me to speak, to live freely, because protecting my ability to speak and live freely will create that culture where they can have more privileges, and also will protect themselves. Okay, the only way for me to protect my privileges is for everyone to realize that protecting my privileges is inherently part of protecting their privileges to speak, to live a life of their own choosing. At the end of the day, like, again, libertarianism is all about the individual. But at the end of the day, like, it's about individuals being within a society. At the end of the day, libertarianism wouldn't matter if I was one person on an island. Okay, there's no one for me to worry about using violence against me, or me using violence against them, or ethics or anything like that. Okay, the libertarian individualistic ethic's purpose is to allow for a society to exist, to allow for a society to function. And the idea generally is having a culture where we value our individual autonomy, our individual consent, our individual interactions with each other. It's a society where all of us are going to sort of have the maximum potential to have as many privileges as possible. There is no guarantee. There's never a guarantee. Even when you call it a right and government pays for it, there is no guarantee you have it. Again, there isn't enough teachers. There isn't enough, necessarily enough doctors to just sit there and say, hey, everyone has it. Okay? You can decree it, but it doesn't make it so. If anything, it makes it less so. Hopefully, you guys appreciate what I had to say today. My name is Alex Merced from alexmerced.com. I have updated alexmerced.com with a lot more of my social media links, so that way you can find out where you can follow what I have to say wherever. Have a great day. Subscribe to the podcast, share with your friends, enjoy, and I'll talk to you guys later.